Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Mike Cross, who's an Alexander Technique teacher in Aylesbury, England, which is north of London. And we're going to discuss today the whole question of how the Alexander Technique can be useful for working with children. This is an area that I personally, don't have a huge amount of experience with, but Mike has, I think, done more work in this area than I have, and we're going to just talk about how, well, if you're a parent, what would be a reason for sending your child to an Alexander Technique teacher, for example? Do you want to address that question?
Yeah, well, the Alexander work itself is not so useful for children as it is for adults. So if you're the parent of a child who's got coordination problems, dyslexia, dyspraxia, I would certainly recommend having some Alexander work to help you understand what the cause of the problem is and how important good coordination is.
So that as a parent, you know what it is that you're wanting to help your kid with, really.
For children themselves, we use movement more, Robert. Mm-hmm. So for adults, the Alexander work is a question of saying no to your reaction to certain ideas and certain stimuli, and thinking out what we call giving directions, thinking out how you want to use yourself in a new way, and then finally going into movement. That part is important. So it's thinking and then going into movement. With children, the movement is really all important. So it's difficult to get them to say no and to think in such a considered way. But by doing certain movements, especially very slowly, that can help their coordination and development.
What could you provide an example of something along those lines?
Yeah. The really important movement that many children don't do is crawling on their hands and knees. That's if we're talking about children from 6 months after birth or onwards. Before that, in the first 6 months, what's really important, and Jennifer Callow picked this up on the interview that you did with her, Robert, is spending time on the tummy. Children don't spend enough time on their tummy because of the fear of cot deaths.
Yes, and that's the point. And the interview was one with Jennifer Callow, which is also a podcast earlier on. And she makes the point that the fear in the States, it's called SIDS, I guess, sudden infant
death syndrome.
Yeah, a big issue in the States. And the Pediatric Society here has basically told parents not to let kids sleep on their stomach because of the dangers of that. And whether or not to me, that sounds a little like maybe missing the point, but I'm not a baby expert. But the fact is that a lot of parents will not let their babies lie on their stomach. So Jennifer came up with some suggestions of how to compensate for that.
And Jennifer is in the medical profession, so yes. She has to be very careful.
Very careful, yeah.
About what she says. But I haven't got any position anywhere, so I'm quite at liberty to say that that advice that not to put babies on their tummy is rubbish. Babies should go on their tummy and do spend lots of time on their tummy, making the movements which are necessary if they're going to inhibit, if they're going to let the brain get control of certain primitive reflexes with which a baby is born. So I should explain what a reflex is. A reflex is an automatic stereotypical response to a stimulus. It could be any stimulus. A very important one is the panic reflex. So if you take a newborn baby and drop it, its arms will fly out in the air, its skin will go red, and so on. That panic reflex is a reflex which should be there to help a baby survive. And it should be there for the first few months. But then the brain, because it's made certain movements, because the body's made certain movements, the brain gets control over that reflex. And if you drop a baby of, say, 2 or 3, it might exhibit a kind of a startle pattern, which is a more mature response, but it wouldn't exhibit the full-blown panic reflex. Its arms wouldn't fly out and so on. So if children don't make the movements that they need to make, these primitive reflexes get stuck in the system. And that's the cause, that's the root cause of dyslexia, dyspraxia, hyperactivity, all kinds of problems that would seem to be on the increase in America and in Britain.
Mm-hmm. So I think we should make it really clear that neither one of us is offering medical advice of any kind. And if you're a parent and you are following the guidelines of not letting your baby sleep on his stomach, there are some things you can do to compensate for the issues that you just talked about. And one of them you're suggesting is crawling and creeping, for example. Are those the...
Well, if the baby hasn't spent enough time on its tummy in the first 6 months, then find ways for it to spend time on its tummy later on, where the fear of SIDS has passed. The very, very important movement is crawling on hands and knees. Yes, it also explain why it's so important. I'd need to explain a little bit about two reflexes in particular. Some of the children we see, a lot of the children we see, have problems with handwriting. Now, there are going to be some parents who'll listen to this and know that I'm just talking about their child, that the child might be quite intelligent, quite bright, but as soon as it's got a pen or a pencil in its hand, it can't think. And the cause of that, Alexander himself, if you look at what he wrote about children struggling to do writing and drawing, he was looking at children who had an immature, asymmetrical tonic neck reflex, is what it's called. That sounds very scientific and off-putting, but what it is... When a baby turns its head in the womb, if it turns its head to one side, its arms will go into a kind of fencer position. Its legs will to some extent too. So it's an asymmetrical tonic neck reflex, or a fencer reflex, we could call it. And so as long as that reflex is in the system, as soon as the child's head turns to one side, the arm on that side will want to extend. And that being the case, when the child comes to do things like handwriting and drawing, consciously it'll want its arm to, say, flex, but the reflex will unconsciously want the arm to extend. So immediately a conflict is set up within the child's system between its conscious intention and what the reflex wants it to do. So when parents phone us up and say, oh, my child's got problems with handwriting, 100 times out of 100, that reflex is more or less immature. It hasn't been integrated properly. And so that reflex splits the body into left and right. It stops the two sides getting in communication with each other. So as long as that reflex is immature, it prevents cross-pattern movements like cross-pattern crawling or cross-pattern marching. It prevents the child from doing those movements. So if you ask a child to march up and down and it sets off, say, it puts its left foot forward and its left arm forward together, immediately in the playground, the other children know that child has something not quite right with it. It doesn't look coordinated.
So the technical term, I think, is what, homolateral walking as opposed to heterolateral?
That's right.
So... So the way you would work with kids that have these issues is you would get them crawling and you would direct them a bit in how they crawl.
Absolutely, but the first thing to do though is to be aware of the true cause of the problem. If a group of these reflexes are immature, especially the fear reflexes, you know, the panic reflexes, it's a physical problem. It's a real physiological problem that this primitive reflex, the inhibitory circuits have not formed and got it under control. But the symptoms of it tend to be very emotional and psychological. So that, you know, the same thing applies with adults. If the reflex has stayed immature into adulthood, the adult might be accused of having all kinds of psychological problems, agoraphobia and irrational anxiety and so on. And when you recognize the real physical basis for the problem, that's a great thing in itself. And it's the same thing with parents and children. When you understand, like that the handwriting reflex I was talking about, when you understand what's causing the problem, it makes your response a lot more enlightened to it. So Alexander talked about this, that if a child's got a problem with handwriting, it's no use saying, you know, don't grip the pen so hard, or, you know, sit up straight and put your head like so and so. What's required is what Alexander called coordination on a general basis. And part of that will be crawling on hands and knees, or doing movements on the tummy, or doing things to retrain the balance mechanisms of the inner ear. But it's Alexander's insight is what would come the first thing, to understand the cause of the problem, and then being reticent, reluctant to sort of dive in and try and change it without having really understood what the cause is.
Okay. Now, I want to get back to a parent listening to this who might identify with the kind of symptoms that you've described, could see that in their kid. Do you have any suggestions that they might have for working on their own with their kid, or do you think they should go to take the kid to, I don't know, an Alexander teacher? Or what would be your advice?
Most Alexander teachers wouldn't really know, wouldn't really understand the problem as I'm describing it. So I was interested with what Jennifer said when you asked her about working with babies. She said she really worked with the parents, and the parents had a good influence on the children.
Right. So is the takeaway message then that if you're a parent and you're child is exhibiting those kind of behaviors, that maybe the first thing you should do is take some lessons yourself?
Well, the first thing you should do really is not intervene to make things worse in your efforts to make things better.
Don't tell your child not to grip the pen so tightly.
That's right.
Because that's not going to accomplish anything useful.
Exactly. Okay. Try to understand the real basis of the problem. And Alexander lessons could help with that. Certainly, Alexander lessons would help you not do what Alexander called end-gaining, which means going directly for the target that you have in mind before you've really understood what the problem in a broader sense. And when we work with children, say from sort of 7, 8, 9 year olds, a big part of the problem is getting the mother usually not to look for a magic solution. You know, that's what mothers want. They just want to fix my child's problem, and it's very, very difficult. In the past we've tried saying, you know, we want you as a parent to have Alexander lessons so you'll understand the whole process, but it actually doesn't work because they're not motivated to learn the Alexander. You know, that's just us, you know, forcing them into some a path they're not necessarily inclined to go down. What I would recommend the parents to do in the first instance is get the right information. And if people look on my webpage, there's a bibliography on that. The books of Sally Goddard Blythe are very, very good to explain how the immature primitive reflexes cause the problems that children with poor coordination have. Let me give you another example, Robert. And I've talked about the reflex that splits the body from side to side. The other, another movement reflex that crawling on hands and knees helps with is a reflex that splits the body from top to bottom, which is the cat sit reflex. The baby usually exhibits after about between about six and seven months after it's been born. What happens with that is the baby looks up, its neck extends, and when the neck extends, the arms extend, and the hips and knees flex, so the baby goes into the cat sit position. Or the other way around, if the neck flexes, the arms flex and the hips and knees extend, so the baby kind of does a bridge with its bottom sticking in the air. Now, if the baby doesn't crawl on its hands and knees for long enough, that reflex will get stuck in an immature form in the system, so that when the child is sitting at its desk at school, if it looks down at its notebook and its neck flexes, the hips and knees automatically will extend. And so the reflex will cause the child to stand up. Without any volition on the child's part, the reflex makes the child stand up. And so the teacher will say, you know, stop being an ant in the pants, you know, sit down. Or because the child has stood up, he might think, well, I better justify my having stood up and ask if he can go to the toilet or go and sharpen his pencil. And so then the child's behaviour is liable to be interpreted as being disruptive or he's an awkward child. If people don't recognise that the reflex, a physical reflex, is causing the problem, then the response won't be appropriate. Mm-hmm. So again, my advice would be, first of all, before you start trying to fix anything, understand really what's going on.
So do some basic research, and we'll put a link to your site next to the interview, and on your site are some resources where parents can learn more about these reflex issues. But I want to get back to once, let's say a parent has done that research and has some understanding of the ideas, theoretically has an idea, understanding of the ideas. What are some practical things that they can do to help the situation? Would one of them be to encourage their kid to do a bit of crawling?
Absolutely.
Get down
absolutely.
On the floor and say...
That's right.
Yeah, it's to actually do some crawling.
Yeah, I mean, so you've got to make it a game, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
I'd say to you, Robert, I'm a lion and you're a giraffe. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to be looking up at the giraffe. That caused me to stretch the neck out and stimulate the reflex. And then I would be crawling after you slowly and then fast. Then we'd switch around. I'd be the giraffe, you'd be the lion. That kind of, use your imagination to make crawling fun. Or
so you want
to
do something that'll cause the rate of crawling to change from slow to fast to slow again?
Yeah, the main thing is for them to crawl a lot.
At varying speeds.
Well, the varying speeds isn't necessarily important, but generally the slow movements are very good for giving the brain a chance to build up the inhibitory circuits that sort the reflexes out. So slow movement is quite powerful. Movement against resistance is powerful. So that you can make it a trial of strength, whether the child is crawling forward, pushing against you, resisting, or even crawling backwards when you've got your hands on its bottom, pushing it the other way. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to, you know, just to describe it like this, because another aspect is how the child is crawling.
And that's where the Alexander technique might come in, right?
Absolutely. Crawling with good use is better than crawling.
So it does seem to me that a parent who's intrigued by what we're talking about would do well to explore having some lessons in the Alexander technique themselves. Now, as you said, a lot of parents can't be bothered doing that, but maybe there's some that could. And one motivator might be that, apart from all of these reflex issues that you've been talking about, one of the ways that kids learn patterns of posture and movement is by imitating adults that they're around, and if they're around their parents a lot, they're going to start copying those patterns. Alexander actually wrote about that in one of his books. He's writing, I guess, in the early part of the 20th century, and he's using a little bit, somewhat archaic language, but he says, you know, when parents go to choose a nursemaid for their kid, they go for the cheapest one, and that might not be the best way to do it, because really what they should be looking for in a caretaker, what a parent should be looking for in a caretaker, is someone that's using their own body fairly efficiently, because to the extent that the caretaker has, say, harmful patterns of posture and movement, a kid is going to pick up on that pretty much instantly. Kids observe that very closely.
Absolutely.
And Alexander also pointed out that the what makes it even more important is that kids are very quick at picking up on the most bizarre harmful patterns. They go for the extremes. So
not only observing with their eyes, but also my wife is very keen on this, because she teaches swimming to nervous swimmers, and also to children who are starting out. And she's very keen on the fact that if a mother holds the baby in the water, if the mother is relaxed, the baby relaxes in the water. But a lot of us have fear patterns we bring into swimming or just being in the water, and the baby very, very quickly picks those up through the sense of touch.
And the sense of touch and just being in the presence of people.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of mirror neuron type research now that sort of explains that. But for sure, you as a parent are having a very profound postural/movement influence on your kid just by being in the same room with them, particularly when they're very young and they're watching you closely. They're getting a lot of cues from you about how to sit, stand, move, and do everything. So maybe a good place, this might be a good place to kind of sum it up, that if you are a parent and your child seems to have some developmental issues of the kind we've been talking about, you might want to for sure go to Mike Cross's website, where he has some resources that will help educate you about what some of these problems are. And you might want to experiment with getting your child to do some crawling, as you've described. And if there's an Alexander teacher in your area, it would probably be pretty useful for you to have at least a few Alexander lessons. I think in most cases, it's probably not such a great idea to send your kid for Alexander lessons, because that's, from the kid's point of view, just another way of trying to fix me, and they're not likely to be terribly receptive to going to see another expert about their situation. But do you want to add any other specific suggestions to that for our listeners?
Just to agree with what you said, Robert, the best thing the parent can do, I think, would be to not try, in the first instance, not to be too quick to try and put the problem right.
Mm-hmm. Because that's likely just to increase the amount of extra tension, and it's almost certainly not going to work. It's about as useless as telling a kid to sit up straight, for example, which we've talked about in an earlier interview. It just doesn't work.
They will
do something in response to that, but what they're going to do is not going to be anything that's going to help them, and chances are they're not going to stay there anyway. So maybe
if I could just add one thing, Robert,
sure,
just relevant. I know on your website you have some information about the Tomatis work, listening work.
Yes, Dr. Alfred Tomatis, a French ear doctor, I guess, has developed a whole methodology of retraining people using sounds, filtered sounds, and very interesting work and very interesting parallels to the Alexander technique. Yeah.
Yeah. And children with developmental problems, their problems are largely centered in the ear. So the reflexes we've been talking about are more the vestibular part of the ear, which is to do with movement. But they will also tend to, the children with those problems will also tend to have a more generalized listening problem. So they're bad at listening to their body. They're also bad at listening to the outside world. So that is another thing to look into for parents who've got children with developmental problems. You can't really go too far on with listening work.
And so if there is a Tomata Center in your area, I think their website, I have to find out what their main website is. If you happen to be in France and you're listening to this, apparently there are zillions of Tomata centers in France. I don't think in America there are that many. And I have no idea what the situation is like in England for Tomatas.
Well, there's something called the listening program, which I administer, which is just very easy to administer program. It's not individualized. It's a 10-week course of listening to 10 CDs, but that can be a good starting point because
And
it's.
do you have a link to that on your website?
Yes, there's a link to that
Okay.
on my website
So
as well.
that's something that you could get. I guess we could call it a slightly stripped down version of the Tomatis method.
That's right.
And
And
that may do the trick for a small kid, I would think.
well, if the child really gets engaged in listening, its use, what we call in Alexander's terms, its use, how it uses itself, will improve. Because the desire to listen, if you think of a rabbit with its ears pricked up, if you get the child listening, a lot of so-called postural improvements will take place.
Right. I mean,
So,
Tomatis actually uses the term listening posture, and if
yeah.
you read his description, it sounds pretty Alexandrian to me.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. So again, if you're a parent and let's say there's no Alexander teacher nearby, you've read the material on Mike's site, see if you look into perhaps getting those CDs, or if there's a Tomatis center near you, taking your child for that program. If there's an Alexander teacher around, for sure that would be useful for you, the parent, and the teacher might even be able to give you some suggestions for helping your child, depending on the teacher. Most Alexander teachers don't particularly specialize in working with children, but some do.
Every good Alexander teacher should be able to teach the parent the virtues of not end gaining, not going
Absolutely.
directly, and that's what we're all to
Yeah.
benefit from, isn't it, Robert?
Absolutely. So I think probably we should end with that. My guest today has been Mike Cross, who's an Alexander Technique teacher in Aylesbury, England, and we've been talking about working with children with developmental issues or coordination issues and the like. Mike, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Robert. It's been a great pleasure. Thanks a lot.